One word, four syllables, so very much riding on it. Globalization. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Tuesday today, the 28th day of June. Great, as always, to have you along, everybody. Here with your American politics public service announcement. We've got 20 days left until Republicans gather in Cleveland, Ohio, for their convention. 27 days until the Democrats meet in Philadelphia, and 133 days until Election Day. We provide those signposts because in the past couple of days, both major parties' presumptive nominees have given big economic policy speeches. Hillary Clinton yesterday and then Donald Trump today, in which he laid out an unusual platform for a GOP nominee. Very anti-free trade, very anti-globalization. We got Neil Irwin, a senior economics correspondent for The New York Times, on the line for a little bit of perspective on this. Neil, it's good to talk to you again.
Thanks for having me.
This was a remarkable speech for a presumptive Republican nominee.
Yeah, this is a Republican nominee for president, most likely, saying, I am going to back away from these trade agreements. We're going to return to a world where there's lots of steel workers and we don't have as much international competition. And that's new territory.
He was fact-checked, I guess you could call it, or rebutted in real time by the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, traditionally a Republican economic ally, by the National Association of Manufacturers, again, traditionally on the side of business. What do you make of that in terms of where this goes for the next 5 months till the election?
Well, what we're seeing is business interests, which are one of the core parts of the Republican constituency or the Republican coalition, are not at all sold on Donald Trump. And today's speech did nothing to change that. In fact, it exaggerated it. If you're a big multinational company, if you're based in the U.S. but trying to do business all over the world, a Trump presidency right now is quite scary for you. And so, this is an odd situation in which a Republican nominee is trying to get to the left of on a business-related issue of the Democratic candidate, and business groups in Washington do not like it one bit.
Well, you mentioned the Democratic candidate, presumptive, I think we have to say. Secretary Clinton gave a speech yesterday in which she said, and I quote, "I'm going to appoint a trade prosecutor who will report to the president, so we are going to end the abuse of our market, our workers, and our people." One wonders whether she is perhaps a little late to the economic populism.
Yeah, it's really interesting seeing Hillary Clinton, who's, her husband signed the NAFTA bill and made the North America Free Trade Agreement happen. She's herself said she is against the current version of the Trans-Pacific Partnership that President Obama is advocating, that she wants to see some changes to NAFTA and take a more aggressive stance on trade. I think a lot of people are skeptical of just how anti-trade she would really be in office. I think the track record of Democrats, including Obama, including Bill Clinton, is that they talk a big game, but then they get into office and they are more accepting of trade agreements than they suggested.
A word here about the practicalities of Mr. Trump's speech, the idea that he is going to raise tariffs, the idea that he is going to pull us out of NAFTA. Can he, on day one, as they say, do all of that?
Not really. The truth is, with something like NAFTA, this has been in place for 25 years. There's an entire elaborate set of trade relationships, supply chain relationships built up on both sides of both the U.S.-Canada border and the U.S.-Mexico border. These are not things that can change overnight. It would be very dangerous if you tried to change them overnight. The question is he fundamentally selling a different era? Is he fundamentally mm-hmm. selling, we can bring manufacturing jobs back that are fundamentally driven by automation and not just trade? And the question is, you can have tougher negotiations, you can have, threatened tariffs and retaliatory things, but is that going to change the basic reality that manufacturing jobs have been going away for a long time?
Just because the moment demands it, is there a parallel here to the Brexit vote and the idea of pulling up the drawbridge in some degree?
I think there absolutely is. I mean, there's just no question that both Trump and Brexit were driven by these deep senses of loss and a sense of a moment in time that has passed in which, these countries, whether the U.S. or Britain, could kind of stand on their own and do their own thing, and there were good working class jobs in manufacturing. That era has passed, and we're seeing a retaliatory push politically against that in both countries.
Neil Irwin is a senior economics correspondent at The New York Times. Neil, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Kai.
Here's a little bit of perspective on Wall Street for you. The Dow was down 261 points yesterday. It was up 269 today because, of course, capitalism. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. So about that Brexit vote Neil and I ended on just a minute ago, outgoing UK Prime Minister David Cameron was in Brussels today for what must have been an awkward meeting with his European Union counterparts. Because, really, it's a tricky situation. When somebody decides to leave your club, do you say good riddance, don't let the door hit you on the way out and take a hard line? Or do you say, hey, no hard feelings, in the hopes of a better economic future? Marketplace's Mark Garrison has that one.
Let's define our terms for the moment. Nasty is out means out. No special trade deal for the UK, restrictions, tariffs. Nice means the UK exits but maintains access to the European single market. We're simplifying, of course, as there are many possibilities beyond these extremes. Nasty carries risks. The UK is the world's fifth largest economy. Taking a hard line would threaten trade and increase uncertainty, says Paolo Mauro, senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics.
The UK and Europe need to trade together. It makes a lot of sense for people and businesses to be moving throughout Europe.
Still, some high-level European leaders are signaling support for nasty over nice.
There have been rather hot-tempered responses.
That's Michael Lee, a German Marshall Fund senior fellow and former European Commission official. He's referring to warnings from the French and European Commission presidents.
Their main preoccupation is to give a lesson to any other country that might be considering going down this path.
Those looking for hints as to whether nice or nasty will prevail focus on one person, explains Heather Conley, who directs the Europe program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies.
The critical voice here, as in so many things with any European issue, is going to be German Chancellor Angela Merkel.
Merkel has given nice signals, saying the UK should have time to think. But she's also warning that the UK won't be allowed to cherry-pick terms. In any case, Europe's nasty and nice sides will duel for influence until at least September, when the UK expects to have a new prime minister. I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
Here's one of the things that's going to be happening in the next couple of weeks and months. A series of stories about how the UK leaving the European Union might be felt across global trade. Here's our entry. Today, pharmaceutical executives trying to figure out what last week's vote will mean for them as far as regulatory approval and research funding and consumer prices as well. From the Health Desk at WHYY in Philadelphia, PA, Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein is on that one.
As far as Mike Thompson's concerned, it's time to get down to business.
Europe actually is very skilled at doing deals. That's what it does best.
Thompson is the head of the Association of the British Pharmaceutical Industry, a trade group. The deal Thompson hopes for is one where Great Britain doesn't raise the drawbridge all the way up, instead maintains some sort of relationship with the EU.
Which allows the UK to still participate in critical areas like the single market. And that's the challenge for the politicians now, is to negotiate that over the next couple of years.
Even if the industry ultimately gets what it wants, Stanford economist Nicholas Bloom says there's so much uncertainty right now, he expects drug companies to pause research and development projects.
Europe is the world's second largest market after the U.S., and it's clearly in crisis. You know, the government is the major customer. Governments across Europe are likely to be slamming the brakes on spending if there's another recession.
While there's a lot of hand-wringing, Gillian Woollett from the consultancy group Avalere suggests everyone chill out.
There's concerns to be heard, but as far as the scientific establishment is concerned, I don't think it's a sweeping change that demands an acute response.
Woollett predicts for the industry, Brexit will be a distraction. She says the old model still holds. If you've got good ideas, good scientists, and good companies with good products, they'll find a way to market. It's just a question of how quickly those new drugs will get into the UK. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
We're out this week with a new edition of our national survey. The Marketplace Edison Research Poll is the official name, in which we track how Americans are feeling about the economy. In one word, anxious. In a couple of words, and to be clear, this was before the Brexit vote that we were talking to people about this, but in a couple of words, anxious and suspicious. Larry Rosen is the president of our partners in this poll, Edison Research. Larry, it's good to have you back.
Hey, Kai.
I want to ask you, first of all, about how we are feeling in this country about the economy. Anxiety levels are rising in the course of the polls that we've done, the first three waves, at a time when, generally speaking, the economy is doing better.
Right. And this is something we've seen pretty consistently in our polling, is that if you look at a lot of sort of fundamentals that economists put out and the government puts out, it seems to argue that things aren't so bad. But when you talk to people about their personal situation, they express a lot of anxiety about their personal economy. And with each wave of the survey that we've done, the number continues to go up.
Yeah.
People are telling us that they're, many of them are sort of living on the financial edge. We see people who have multiple obligations. They might have a parent that they're have financial obligations to help with, on top of having children in the household, on top of having personal debt or student loan debt or a mortgage, etc. And so you see how all of these different stressors can play upon people.
To the part of the economy that we started the program with today, the future of it, Donald Trump's speech today, Secretary Clinton's speech the other day about the economy. We asked some people about trade, which was very heavily the focus of Mr. Trump's speech today. People in this country agree, basically, that trade is in some ways the root of the evil.
Yes, there's a very strong majority of Americans who look at deals we've made or their perception of deals that the government has made with regard to trade and believe that those deals have hurt manufacturing jobs and hurt them individually. And it's such an interesting part of the political discussion this year because it's actually an area that seems to unite both the Sanders left and the Trumpian whatever that is, right?
Mm-hmm.
Both groups agree that, you know, international trade has not worked out well for the average American.
Yeah. And that plays into the last thing I want to talk to you about. It's a conversation that you had with David Brancacci this morning on The Morning Show, which I thought was amazing. People in this country, in a substantial majority, do believe the economy is rigged. That thing that we've been hearing about from both Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders for months, if not years.
Right. And so we actually put the word rigged in the question. Do you believe the economic system is rigged in favor of certain groups? And an overwhelming majority of people agreed with that. 71% of Americans said, yes, the economic system is rigged. And what was so interesting about it was that it didn't matter how you looked at the data, pretty much everyone agreed with that statement. Democrats, Republicans, independents, people of all ethnic backgrounds, no matter which way we slice through the data, people feel that the economy is rigged.
Remind me, we're going to do this one more time before Election Day, right?
Right. We're going to field again in October, right up against the election, and we'll see what the state of anxiety is in the USA right before people make their votes.
Larry Rosen is the president of Edison Research, with whom we have been doing the Marketplace Edison Research poll. There is all kinds of stuff, the data and a quiz and a whole bunch more on our website, marketplace.org. Larry, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Guy.
Coming up, fair trade coffee might be a good idea and all, but
it's definitely not a magic wand that can fix all the world's problems.
First, though, let's do the numbers. All right, so there you go. As I said, the Dow Industrial is up 269 today, 1.5%, closed at 17,409. That's a net plus 8 for the past 2 days. The NASDAQ rose 97 points, 2.1%, 4691. The S&P 500 up 35 points, 1.7%, ended at 2,036. Okay, some basics today. Superior Uniform Group. It makes employee uniforms and scrubs and those hospital gowns that don't quite close in the back. They were up 3%. Commercial Vehicle Group makes the stuff that goes in truck cabs, seats, sleeper boxes, body panels. Commercial Vehicle up 8.5% today. Spartan Motors makes specialty chassis for fire chassis, I don't know, plural, singular, whatever. Fire trucks, big motor homes. Shares up 1.5% today. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 1.46%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Airbnb is going to court with the city it calls home. It is suing San Francisco, trying to block a new ordinance that would let the city fine the company over unregistered apartment listings on the site. At the core of the case is something called the Communications Decency Act, which, not to get all legalese on you here, but it says that online platforms aren't responsible for the content posted by users. So, is Airbnb just a platform, or are its postings the very heart of its business? Gigi Duban reports.
For every rental unit listed on Airbnb that isn't registered with the city, the company would be fined $1,000 a day.
what we're saying is the only way to enforce this law is to inject corporate responsibility into it by fining the hosting platform.
David Campos is on the San Francisco Board of Supervisors and is the main author of the new ordinance. There are thousands of Airbnb rental units in the city, and roughly 80% aren't registered. Asking Airbnb to ensure they are registered is no different than renting a car, Campos says.
Before Hertz can rent you a car, it has to check that you have a driver's license.
But Airbnb isn't renting cars, nor is it just a few people buying classified ads to rent out extra rooms.
That's not very disruptive to anyone, to any status quo. Probably not going to attract the attention of regulators in the city.
That's Andrew McAfee, co-founder of MIT's Initiative on the Digital Economy. He says Airbnb operates on a huge scale. It's in 34,000 cities in 191 countries.
These are significant businesses, and they're reshaping cities and reshaping industries and economies.
McAfee says the court ruling will probably set a precedent for other cities and could pave the way for more legal battles. I'm Gigi Duban for Marketplace.
You can love them or you can hate them, but online ads are here to stay. Google and its ad-selling prowess and profits has been well covered. Twitter is fighting the good fight, trying to figure it out. Facebook seems to have it pretty well nailed. Antonio Garcia Martinez is one of the people responsible for that. He is the creator of Facebook Exchange, the social media company's first really successful try at generating ad revenue. His book, which is part memoir, part gossipy Facebook insider tell-all, is called Chaos Monkey. Antonio, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Kai.
You wound up at Facebook running the ad shop, basically, or one key part of the ad shop, right?
It's funny you say that, Kai. There's a running joke inside tech that your title always gets sort of inflated whenever you talk to a journalist. I most certainly did not run the ad system at Facebook.
Well, one part of it, though, right? Right? That thing that came to be called Facebook Exchange?
Yeah, right. So to your listeners, if you go and browse the web and you check out a pair of shoes or whatever at Amazon and then you see things related to it inside Facebook, I created that. I'm the guy you can blame for that.
See, now you're inflating your own title, man. It's not just me.
Literally true, actually. So yeah, I created Facebook Exchange, which is that technology.
But the point is that as Facebook was struggling with ad revenues and making money and figuring out how to take all this data, you found a small piece of the Rosetta Stone.
Yeah, I think so. Part of the reason why Chaos Monkeys, I think, is so interesting is that it covers a period of history in which Facebook really figured out, you know, where its gold mine really was. Basically, every product that Facebook has monetized to a large extent launched in the two-year window that I discuss in Chaos Monkeys. Hmm. And you're right. You know, Facebook Exchange and another similar product called Custom Audiences, which I also helped create, were part of that sort of larger structure.
What was the nut that they had to crack to figure out how to make money? Because there were days post-IPO when we were all going, oh, man, Facebook is done. They can't figure out this advertising thing.
One thing I think is joining to a lot of the what we call intent data in the outside world, browsing for shoes, even mm-hmm. purchases you've made in the offline world, joining your Facebook experience to that was one of the key insights. I think one of the deep sort of abstract insights, though, is that Facebook's real value wasn't so much in what data it has about you, the fact that you liked BMW, say, you know, a year ago or mm-hmm. whatever, or that you're a 35-year-old male in Ohio. It's the fact that Facebook knows who you are on every device you touch. And that's very helpful when it comes to attributing ad spend on mobile versus desktop and just basically keeping track of you on every device you touch.
Online ads bug me, right? Online ads, I think, bug everybody. Most people. How about that? Let me not generalize. But I wonder, as you're in this world, are you you're out just to get the clicks and the view throughs and all of that stuff. You're agnostic about it. You just want to get it done for the technology's sake, right?
I'll use a line on you that every ad tech person does to sort of validate themselves, which is we pay for the internet, right?
Oh yeah, that's a good line.
We are how services like Google and Facebook get paid, you know, basically exist. Without us, none of that would exist. And I don't think we want to go down the rabbit hole of alternative business models. But if you think about charging for Facebook or any other way that you could pay for it, it basically wouldn't work. I mean, ads is what we're stuck with, and there it is.
You are no longer at Facebook, and you're not doing ads for them anymore. Clearly, though, this is in your blood, right?
It's funny because the book is somewhat critical of Facebook, but when I actually express these opinions, everyone still thinks that I'm sort of like a closet Facebook agent who still, you know, sort of virulently believes in the value of Facebook and advertising. But yeah, to some degree, it is in my blood. That's right.
It's a book called Chaos Monkeys, Obscene Fortune and Random Failure in Silicon Valley. It's about a whole lot more than advertising, but I took advantage of the expertise while I was here. Antonio Garcia Martinez is the author. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Kai.
The somewhat unintentional theme of the program today has turned out to be, in one form or another, globalization and the trade that makes that globalization happen. So a story now taking that very big topic down to the granular level. Fair trade coffee, an idea that has given thousands of small-scale coffee growers decent income and a sense of stability. But, and I say this not for the first time, the global economy is a fickle beast. The story from Marfa Public Radio's Lorne Madelon.
So you're in a coffee shop. They pour the beans, they grind the beans, and you want to pay a little bit more to help the people who grew those fair trade coffee beans.
I like to support the workers and the growers in other countries.
That's coffee lover Nisha Kumar. Fair trade coffee is still a niche market. People like Kumar represent about 5% of that market, consumers who pay a few cents more for their cup. Now let's go to southern Mexico, where they're planting coffee trees. Latin America is a huge fair trade coffee producer. Fair trade means relationships with foreign buyers that extend beyond the sale. Cash advances, a steady outlet for the product, a modest but predictable profit, and market data. And the southern Mexican state of Chiapas is a major part of the fair trade mosaic. I'm digging and fertilizing, says Paulino Agustin. The air is sweet. Agustin and two friends are hunkered down on the side of a mountain cloaked in volcanic soil. They're tilling the earth to plant coffee trees, but it takes 3 years for these trees to bear fruit. And right now, coffee prices are low, says Sinael Altamirano.
Aquí no money.
There's no money here, he says. But if prices jump tomorrow, it wouldn't matter. They have producing trees, but they've already contracted to sell those beans into the low-price environment.
Fair trade, it's not a perfect system, and it's definitely not a magic wand that can fix all the world's problems.
Monica Furl used to live in Chiapas. She moved there to learn the business and ended up helping to organize a fair trade coffee co-op. That's where growers sell their coffee together, sharing the risk and reward. Now she's back. She works at Cooperative Coffees. It imports fair trade coffee from three Chiapas co-ops for coffee shops and roasters in the U.S. and Canada.
Prices are set at a commodities market. So for the farmer, what that means is wildly fluctuating prices based more on buying and selling of futures contracts rather than the labor and the care that the farmers put into the fields.
Furl says the key to making fair trade work is banding together and finding a leader who can negotiate for them honestly with foreign buyers. There are stories strewn across Chiapas about co-op leaders who make money for themselves by cutting their own deals with go-betweens.
If these farmers can't get organized in effective exporting cooperatives, they are essentially left at the mercy of the local middlemen, or los coyotes, as they call them in Chiapas.
Coyote is a term used to denigrate human traffickers, smugglers, and here, coffee middlemen. We do call them coyotes, says 72-year-old Ermelindo Mendez. They drive the price down. A lifetime of coffee cultivation is etched onto his face. But he's torn. He says his co-op just isn't getting the job done. That's why he sold to coyotes last year on the side. They paid a higher price than his own co-op could or would. He's not sure.
No disfrutamos de nuestro producto y nuestro trabajo.
We're not benefiting from our work these days, he says. And now, besides low prices, says Monica Furl, a devastating fungus.
They lose 30, 50, maybe 75% of their total production after years of building up their fields. It's very demoralizing.
But fair trade is giving some small farmers a safety net in a messy market. They earn steady money, good times or bad, while the majority of their neighbors struggle. In Chiapas, Mexico, I'm Lorne Madelon for Marketplace.
The Just final note on the way out today, Lizzie O'Leary, the host of our weekend show, has flown into the eye of the global economic storm this week. London, England, the UK, of course. Her story is coming in a day or two or three, maybe. But for now, she has sent along just a taste, a protest against Brexit that she ran into in Westminster today.
I don't think we'll ever actually seriously come out, to be honest. In any serious manner, we will still be tied to the EU one way or another.
I think it is such a mess. I think the result wasn't conclusive at all. It was a very small majority. But I don't know. I think there is no plan and people are just angry and sad and I don't know.
And I feel very cheated. So I feel cheated out of an education and I feel cheated out of options.
How about that sigh that lady had, huh? I don't know. The story that keeps on giving. More from Lizzie and Stephen Beard in a couple of days. All right, we got to go. I'm just going to say it the easy way. The Dow is up 8 points over the past 2 days. Today, the NASDAQ up 97 points, about 2.1%. The S&P 500 up 35 points, 1.7%. Tommy Andres and Vanessa Smith are our elections producers. Caitlin Esch is the producer on our Wealth and Poverty Desk. Our digital team includes Nishad Kerwood, Donna Tam, and Tony Wagner. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.